Acts chapter 28. We are at the point where Paul has arrived in the area of Rome. He's been met by some Christians, perhaps some of the same people that we read about in the book of Romans, Romans chapter 16, the last chapter. And verse 16 says, again, Acts chapter 28, and when we entered into Rome, this was a place that from some perspectives, I guess you could say he was looking forward to. Maybe from some other perspectives, he was not looking so forward to that because he didn't know all the things that might take place. But they eventually, Luke, we believe, is still with him, even though we don't find him specifically mentioned. We have the pronoun we there. When we entered into Rome, Paul was suffered to abide by himself with the soldier that guarded him. Now, you may remember that back in Acts chapter 23 and verse 11, God had told Paul, you are going to get to Rome. So God had made that promise. Now we find the fulfillment of that promise here in Acts chapter 28 and verse 16. But even though God had made the promise, and even though Paul experienced the fulfillment of that promise, do you think that he got there in the way that he imagined? No. I mean, there were, the shipwreck, the time on the island, all that stuff. We had had that promise by God. God says, you're going to get to go to Africa. In our mind, that would probably mean what? How would we envision that trip unfolding and going?
To get on an airplane.
Yeah, the day's going to come. I'll be looking forward to that and get my passport and get the clothing that I need and maybe, take some, items that I like to munch on, some snacks, and I'm going to go over there and it's going to be a great trip. Everything's going to be smooth sailing, so to speak. That's generally how we think, right? Do you think that's how Paul thought that trip was going to be? Yeah. So he probably expected a few bumps in the road, but there were some major hurdles. One source described it this way. I'll give you the quote. He says, instead of coming in a free man, and I think that would be most of us. We wouldn't expect to go to Africa as a prisoner. But that's exactly what happened with Paul. Instead of coming in as a free man to appear in the synagogue and in the forum for the name of Jesus, he marched in between files of soldiers, reported to the authorities as a prisoner, sent up for trial, and kept night and day under a military guard. How poor his prospect for evangelizing the vast population. So one of the practical lessons for us from this is, a lot of times we will pray for something and God will say yes, but the way that prayer is answered is completely unlike what we expect. So when we pray, sometimes we have a certain expectation of things going in this way, but we find that God is running on some very distant track. And he might do that for a lot of reasons. What might some of those reasons be? Here's your thinking. Yes, you're thinking we're going to go from point A to point B, but you do get to point B, but you've got a lot of subpoints, and it seems maybe like there's a very long circular path to getting there. Why is that sometimes, Mom?
Because there's other circumstances that's going to come out.
There are people in life who have free will, and sometimes individuals can not circumvent. They can't stop the prayer, but there will be some detours along the way. So that's one good answer. Why else might not some prayers be directly going from A to B, right?
Might have some work for you to do on the way.
Yeah, there might be some tasks. He says, you can do these things, and it's going to actually benefit some others. You're going to get what you're seeking, but we're going to help some others who may be seeking some additional things in their lives as well. So that's another good reason. Why else? Trace?
Maybe we have a lesson we need to learn.
Yeah, there might be something. We're just ready to jump from A to B, but God says, before you get to B, there are some things that have to happen. So I'm going to slow you down a little bit. I'm going to let you study on this. I'm going to let you learn this. I'm going to let you sort through this. Do you think maybe in going to A to B, we might find that God has a pit stop or two there that at least for the present time and maybe 30 years into the future, we won't understand why there was that pit stop? But maybe after a few decades pass, all of a sudden we say, hey, yeah, I remember that set of circumstances 30 years ago. That happened. I thought we were going to go immediately from this to that, and I'm grateful for that experience, or at least now I'm helped by that experience. So there can be a lot of reasons why God does work in the way that he works, but you do find that Paul does finally get there. Now let's take a look at a couple of passages. We are going to run a few more references here than we have been doing lately. I want to pick up from the first chapter in Acts, Acts chapter 1 and verse 8. And then we also want to flip somebody over to the book of Colossians, the first chapter, Colossians chapter 1 and verse 23. Who wants to be our Acts 1, 8 reader? Acts 1, verse 8, Lois, and our Colossians 1, 23 reader, who will that be? Colossians 1, verse 23, Brian. Okay, Lois, let's read that eighth verse. We especially want to focus on the end of the text.
But you shall receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and you shall be my witnesses both in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria, and even to the remotest part of the earth.
Okay, this is how Acts begins. So he says, you're going to be my witnesses where? You're going to be my witnesses in the city of Jerusalem. And the preaching is going to also extend into where? It's going to go into Judea. And we're even going to reach into Samaria, where the Jews didn't want to spend a lot of time, avoid it if they could. And then finally, it's going to go where? It's even going to go to the remotest parts of the world. When Paul gets to Rome, guess what? Rome pretty much owned how much? I mean, yeah, not 100%, but I mean, when you talked about who was in control of the world, it was Rome. So we find in Acts chapter 1 and verse 8 a start or an indication of how far the gospel was to go. And now as we get over to Acts chapter 28, we do find that Paul is getting there. Now, Lois, I'm going to ask you to skip over to the next chapter, if you would, after we read Colossians 1:23. We want to see if you read Acts chapter 2 and verse 10 for us. That be okay?
Sure.
Acts 2:10. Okay, now let's pick up Colossians 1, verse 23. Brian?
If you continue in the faith, grounded and settled, and be not moved away from the hope of the gospel, which you have heard, and which is preached to every creature which is under heaven, whereof I call him and make the minister.
Okay, this is maybe 5 or 6 years after the time in Acts chapter 28. We don't have enough information to really nail that down, but we think that Paul spends a couple years in Rome. It does appear that he is released when he is there. He writes the prison epistles. So again, I didn't state that very well. Let's back up a little bit. In Acts chapter 28, he spends 2 years in Rome. He writes the prison epistles during that time. One of those prison epistles would be Colossians that Brian read, and then we expect that he's released and maybe has another 4 or 5 years possibly. But as he gets there, as he writes the Colossian letter from the time that we're talking about in Acts chapter 28, he says the gospel has gone how far? It's gone out into all the world. And that, again, there were probably a few places where it hadn't gone, but generally speaking, someone says, I was out mowing grass and it took me all day. Well, what doesn't that mean?
Not literally.
Yeah, we wouldn't take that literally. We wouldn't mean, from literally sun up to sundown where you couldn't, see without lights, but we would say the majority, it consumed, high percentage of the day, and that's exactly what we have in Colossians chapter 1 and verse 23. All right, now, Paul, we've talked about the fact in the last class that there are Christians in the area of Rome that come out to greet him. Now, as you look at that, you might be scratching your head and you're thinking, okay, we know it was God's will for the gospel to go to all parts of the world, Acts chapter 1 and verse 8, but how did Christianity make it to Rome? We're not specifically told, but there may be a hint from the day of Pentecost. Let's see what we have in Acts chapter 2, verse 10. Lois is our reader.
Phrygia and Pamphylia, Egypt, and the districts of Libya around Cyrene, and the visitors from Rome, both Jews and proselytes.
Isn't that interesting? On the day of Pentecost, there were people from where? They came all the way from Rome. Well, if they came all the way from Rome to be there on the day of Pentecost, and some of them were converted, we would expect or hope that at least a few were. You think they're going to go back home?
Eventually.
I would think so. And do you think they're going to take their new faith back home? Practice that. Encourage people, to hear the gospel. We would expect that that would be true as well. So, again, the early chapters in Acts, Acts 1, Acts 2, relate to some of the things that we're talking about and seeing about here in Acts chapter 28. Anything that you want to add or ask? Yes, sir.
We also need to remember, too, that the book of Acts is mostly about Paul towards the end and Peter. They don't talk much about all the other apostles that were
right
now, other than that James and Peter stayed in Jerusalem. But most of the other apostles went out and did their own ministry. And
yeah.
It also talks about in Acts after the persecution of Stephen that they were scattered abroad and everywhere preaching.
So yeah, Acts chapter 8, 1 through 4, exactly right.
So the whole idea of him saying in Colossians that the gospel has been preached everywhere, it is entirely possible with all the apostles that there were, because we know, and even Paul mentioned in some of his writings that there were more apostles than just the 12 main apostles that had the abilities that the apostles did, that were going out and preaching and spreading the gospel, as well as all the other people that weren't apostles that also were teachers and spreading the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we look at Paul as the person who kind of led the way, and he would usually be like the first person in certain areas, but we don't really know about all the other apostles that went out and around and were all over the place doing this similar work that Paul was.
Yes, Paul in fact styles himself. He refers to himself as the apostle to the Gentiles. But there were Jews all over the world. So when we look at Acts, it's not exactly a 50-50 division, but you've got a lot of information about Peter as you look at about the first half of Acts, and then the second half, it sort of switches to Paul, his missionary journeys, and now we've got him here at Rome. And, you know, you've got other guys doing other things as well. James has been taken out by Herod in Acts chapter 12. There has always been a big discussion. Catholicism is big on believing that Peter went to Rome. That's kind of a separate discussion, but there could have been some others that certainly made it that far. I mean, they had that worldwide vision. They understood that Jesus, Matthew 28, Mark 16, Luke 24, said go into all the world, and they certainly were very committed to that. So thank you so much. Anybody else? Okay, let's go and see what else we've got here. I want to give you this quote as far as a little bit of history on Rome. This is a nice summation by Jackson. Rome had been built on seven hills situated on the east bank of the Tiber River. The city limits had a circumference of slightly over 13 miles. The rich lived in sumptuous villas while the poor were packed together in less desirable sections of the community. Now, Paul's going to stay somewhere. So if you have an area, in this case, a very large area, big city, and you've got the rich over here, Richville, and you got the poor over here in Poorville, and Paul comes to town, which ville you think he's going to be in? Richville or Poorville? He's probably going to be in Poorville. He's a prisoner, among other things, and money must have been very, very tight. So we would suspect that that's where Paul probably resided. I'm going to turn on the mic. Probably a little easier to hear. All right, the streets, as one said, were lined with tenant housing, some of which were six or more stories high, jammed together with only a few feet apart, accommodating at least 1 million people. I wish Ray was here this morning. He could probably give us some insight about California or New York. Don, maybe you can help us out a little bit. New York, you ever go down to an area where it's just, I mean, you have almost no green unless they've got a little park. It is just packed.
Manhattan's like that. You don't see any grass in the whole city.
Yeah, I mean, it's just sardines practically. I mean, everybody, you know, kind of got your little space, and so that's a fair assessment.
Yeah, they got a couple parks, but, you know, Central Park and some of their other, but you don't see much.
Okay, so concrete and asphalt. So if you can kind of envision that, then you may have some idea as far as what Rome must have been like, at least the section that Paul was in. By AD 14, the estimated population of Rome had reached just over 4 million people. In the ancient world, Rome had the artistic and literary center of the world. It was filled with entertainment, food, all kinds of luxuries. Again, Don, kind of going back to New York, it sounds like they are somewhat similar. And it said half the year's calendars were designated as holidays. Now, can you imagine that? Living in a culture where half of the year's days are holidays. So it was the place to be, so to speak. Now, if you're a real mover and shaker and some preacher comes into town talking about the gospel, hey, you know, hear, repent, believe, you know, be baptized and, you know, get in the right relationship with God, you think that's going to be a tough message to sell to some people in that culture? There are going to be some people, they're not going to want to hear that. Kind of like going out to Las Vegas, you know, we've got our way of life and we want to stick with it. All right, now, as I read verse 16, anybody have a version where you thought, hey, I think you left a few words out? I'll read it again. And when we entered into Rome, Paul was suffered to abide by himself with the soldier that guarded him. Nobody has a few extra words? Okay, at least one does. The ASV will foot that. There are some late manuscripts which say something like, and when we came into Rome, the centurion delivered the prisoners to the praetorian prefect, but Paul was permitted to dwell by himself with the soldier that guarded him. Now, that clause is not in our earliest manuscripts. In fact, it doesn't appear until the 9th century, so it is very old. Some people have suggested that it was put there to kind of smooth out the text a little bit. So again, if you have that, that's the reason why. Other quick note here, the pronoun we, that's the last reference to Luke in the book of Acts, but it does seem like, at least my view is, that he continued on with Paul. Now, Paul, he's in this place, he's gotten to Rome. Would you say that he has at least a little privacy? Acts 28 and verse 16. Paul was allowed to do what? He was allowed to be by himself. All right, sometimes a person says, I just need to be by myself for a little while. So when that happens, we expect that a person has or wants or needs a little privacy. So Paul did have some degree of privacy. Do you remember how we talked about earlier, that ship that Paul was on, and then it got trashed, and then he's on another ship? Who was on there with him? He had some fellow who?
Some fellow prisoners.
You don't read about those guys here, but once you get to Rome, if you're the fellow who's in charge of guarding the prisoners, where do you think you're going to take the prisoners?
Prison camp.
I think you're going to take them to the big prison camp. They're going to go to prison. But Paul seems to be separate from them. So it looks like they take those guys over to where they need to be kept. But Paul is treated much, much differently. He has a soldier who guards him. Now, a few minutes ago I told you that as you look at Paul's confinement here, it seems like this is the period of time where he writes the prison epistles. Those epistles would be Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians. Anybody want to take a stab at that fourth? Prison epistles. Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, and it's a short book.
Philemon.
Very good. Now, if we were to look at Philippians, and I'd like to do this as a class, Philippians chapter 1 and verse 13. If you read that book, there's a lot of great stuff in there. If you read that book in light of the fact that Paul is writing it from a Roman confinement that he's probably going to be released from, you kind of get a slightly different perspective. Let's see what that 13th verse says in Philippians chapter 1. Who's got it and wants to read it for us? Philippians 1, verse 13. Lois, back to you. Thank you.
So that my imprisonment in the cause of Christ has become well known throughout the whole
Praetorian
Guard and to everyone else.
Okay. The Praetorian Guard. Do you think that these were the troops that were new and they were the least trained? Or you think they were at the other end of the spectrum?
The other end.
All right. They're at the other end. If you're going to protect Nero, you know, you're going to have these would be, anybody remember Star Wars? Okay, we all saw it. They've got, you know, the old stormtrooper over there, you know, the white helmet. But then you got Darth Vader and the kind of guards that he has. And what do you find about Vader's guards? If I remember correctly, they were not dressed in white, they were dressed in what color?
Black.
Yeah, black, and maybe there were even a couple red ones. So these are the special troops. These are the elite troops. I mean, these are the guys, just like today we have when the president goes out. They might use some lower level security, but when it comes to protecting the president, who do they have around him?
More experienced at the top.
Yeah, but what do we call them? The Secret Service. You know, you just don't show up one day and say, hey, I want to, you know, be a Secret Service agent, so I'll take a week of training. Uh-uh. There's going to be a long procedure to get that particular work. So Paul says, I was being guarded. Here you have a single guard, but you tie that in with Philippians chapter 1 and verse 13, and here it is the Praetorian Guard, the guard that would have been associated with Nero. Well, putting two and two together, why do you think the Praetorian Guard became aware of who Paul was and the things that he believed? What do we find from Acts chapter 28 and verse 16? Paul says, what's taking place with my hand? Let's take a look at it again. Paul suffered himself to abide with a soldier that did what? The soldier that guarded him. Now, we haven't gotten into it yet, but how did that guarding take place? Was a guy outside the door? Was he inside? He was inside. And how did that work? Anybody remember from the chapter?
Chained together.
You know, you got to, just like today, we've seen people sometimes, you've seen it perhaps on a movie, maybe you've actually seen it in person. There is maybe someone who is deputized to serve in a special way, maybe a U.S. Marshal. And the Marshal has to transport someone. He's responsible for caring for someone. And they have to go from one side of the country to the other. So they go to the airport. And what's true for that Marshal? On one of his hands, what's he have? A handcuff. Handcuffs have two cuffs. And who's he cuffed to, or she?
The prisoner.
All right, the prisoner. All right, that's what's taking place with Paul. He's allowed to abide by himself, and we'll see a little bit more about that as we continue through the text, and he's chained to this person. Well, if, as we continue to move through the text, we find that Paul is having people come in, and he's having discussions with people, and you're the fellow who's cuffed to him, what's going to be true for you?
You're
going to hear all that stuff. And do you think that even if you were uninterested in the gospel, you'd still want to listen carefully to what he says? I think so. Why? You might get some really good information. And if you have already made it to the Praetorium Guard level, and you're able to come out with some secretive information, maybe a plot against the emperor's life or something else, you think that might be a pretty good career move for you? I suspect those guys were listening to every single thing that he said. And if you listen to somebody long enough, and it oftentimes doesn't take that long, but you listen to somebody long enough, and you can kind of get a pretty good sense of, you know, they're just full of nonsense, or this stuff really makes sense. And you might listen long enough where it says, you know, that not only makes sense to me, I have some what for you? I have some
questions
for you. You've given some pretty good answers, but let me ask you a couple more questions about your God. Let me ask you a couple more questions about your faith. So Paul, as he is working, and he's probably doing some of his best work here. You can see that, I think, from the prison epistles. It really is an amazing thing. As we continue to move down through the chapter, here's some things. We're going to find that he's reaching out to the unsaved. That's going to come next in verse 17. He's going to continue to explain and teach. We'll see that in verses 22 and 23. He's also doing some persuading as we get down to verse 24. He's doing some preaching as we get down to verse 31. And then, as you look at 28, 23, he's doing that from morning until evening. So the people who are guarding him, they are hearing the gospel hour after hour after hour every day. And then as you get down through to verse 30, you find that he's doing this for 2 years. Now, you're either full of him and sick of him by that two-year period, or you've heard enough to make a believer out of you, and probably some pretty strong Christians. So it's not surprising that when we get into Philippians, we find that kind of reference. Anything that you want to add or ask before we move down to verse 17? Okay. He says, and it came to pass that after 3 days he called together those these will be Jews, that were chief of the Jews, and when they were come together, he said unto them, my brethren, though I had done nothing against the people or the customs of our fathers, yet was delivered prisoner from Jerusalem into the hands of the Romans. All right. How long did it take for Paul to settle in? 3 days. Sometimes we'll get to an area, if you've ever gone perhaps for vacation, you have driven perhaps to an area, you've flown to an area, and you get in, you kind of make the initial walk through the place to kind of figure out what's what and start unpacking things. And, you know, that first day you feel somewhat settled. You know, second day, you know, we kind of have, but by day three, how do you feel? But, you know, okay, we've got the run of the place. You know, we can grocery store, and, you know, we know where the gas station is and some other things in town. So we're ready to really begin the vacation if it's a brand new spot. So Paul's also coming as a prisoner. And I think that really shows a good bit of balance. I mean, he's thrust into a new place and everything is brand new. But he doesn't wait all that long before he wants to get down to business and start teaching the gospel to people. And that's exactly what we're reading about here. Well, let me rephrase that. Why doesn't he just go out and start working with the Jewish synagogues? I'm going to go out there and talk to this one today and talk to this one next Saturday. Why doesn't he do that? Somebody said it right. Who? Whisper a little louder.
He's a prisoner.
So he is under house arrest. But even today, I've never been under house arrest, but my understanding of it is, you know, you're pretty limited in what you can do, unless they give you authorization to go to work or authorization to be out during certain hours like a fast. I mean, you have to stay at the house. So they surely did not want Paul traipsing all over Rome. So he has to hang out there. So he's got a spot where he can have people come in, and after that third day, he's ready to get down to business. So who does he call for? Who would you call for if you were in Paul's shoes? All right, you know, you kind of start from the top, right? And if you can get the top on board, then what's going to be true for the people who are, if you will, under them? It's going to trickle down. Trickle-down economics is what they used to talk about. So that's going to be the kind of effect that we have here. So Paul calls for these men, and that word shows that Paul had a great interest in these men. I'm not exactly sure how he reached them. I think one possibility would be if, as we talked about from before, Acts chapter 2 and verse 10, there were some people who were from Rome, they came to Jerusalem for the day of Pentecost, they go back. If they became Christians, you have then Jews who would have been familiar or unfamiliar with people in the synagogues, probably still. I think they probably would have been familiar still with them. So it's very likely that Paul was able to reach out to some people who had been converted, they were Christians, and said, hey, I'm in town. I want to talk to the synagogue leaders, the synagogue rulers, influential Jews who are in Rome. So these men, they're willing to come. They've been called to Paul, and they do show up. And how does Paul address them? We've seen this before in the book of Acts. He refers to these men as
brethren.
What does that mean, and what doesn't that mean? You can take it either way. What does that mean, or what does that not mean?
You're Christians.
Okay. When Paul refers to these chief Jews as brethren, are we saying that they were Christians? All right. They were influential Jews, but they were not Christians. Why, if they were not Christians, would he refer to them as brethren? I'm sorry? All right. They had that common ancestry. They were that was a common way to refer to people. So sometimes people see that word and say, yes, it refers to Christians here, but that is not always the case. So we have these men. Some have thought of them as Jewish dignitaries. That's certainly possible. And Paul, he begins by telling them, look, I have not done anything against the people. And that, of course, would be a reference to the Jewish people. He says, I've not shown any disrespect. I've not tried to show any kind of disdain for the customs of our fathers. When it comes to harming the Jewish people, Paul says, I want to harm them, I want to hurt them, or I don't. That's the last thing on my mind. But even though I have not wanted to harm the Jewish people, what has happened to me?
Prisoner.
Yeah, I was delivered as a prisoner from Jerusalem into the hands of the Romans. Well, who do you think did that? The Jews did. So Paul kind of touches on that. He skirts the issue a little bit. He acknowledges that. They're probably wondering, well, why are you here? So Paul says, you know what, say a little bit about that, but then we're going to move on. Sometimes when people talk about a sensitive subject, they will make a quick point. They will maybe acknowledge it or try to skirt it, and then it is move on. McGarvey, an older commentator, remember the church, he compared Paul to Joseph as a slave in Potiphar's house and a prisoner in a king's prison. He said he conducted himself as to win the implicit confidence of those who had him in charge from the beginning to the end of his confinement. So it must ever be with him who maintains under all circumstances a strictly Christian deportment. We see doing this very thing by saying he became a prisoner in Jerusalem and was given into the hands of the Romans. Paul omitted a lot of favorable and unfavorable treatment by the Jews as he lays out this information, but he is trying to win them. Anything that you might ever ask before we look at verses 18 through 20? Okay. 18 says, who, when they had examined me, desired to set me at liberty. Now, Paul's talking about the past, what had brought him ultimately to Rome. Because there was no cause of death in me. That takes us back to Felix and Festus and the king. But when the Jews spake against it, I was constrained to appeal unto Caesar, not that I had aught whereof to accuse my nation. For this cause, therefore, did I entreat you to see and to speak with me. For because of the hope of Israel, I am bound with this chain. Now, I want to run some references here. Paul said I was delivered to the Roman authorities. That's in verse 17. And then he says, they examined me. I want to focus our attention on the word which is translated examined. I want us to see how that word is used in some other places. We'll run these as a class. Go a little slower that way. Luke chapter 23 and verse 14. Now, this is a passage about Jesus, and the person who is doing the examining is the person that we want to pick out. I think you can figure it out, but we'll go ahead and have somebody read that, Luke 23 and verse 14, and take a couple of details from the text. Steve, 23:14 in Luke.
Said to them, you have brought this man to me as one who misleads the people, and indeed having examined him in your presence, I have found no fault in this man.
Okay, who was the guy who said, I find no fault with Jesus?
Pilate.
It was Pilate. Very good. Now, let's think about Pilate's examination of Jesus. He's the governor of Judea. What kind of examination, what kind of checking out of Jesus do you think he did? Ask him a couple questions. Do you think it was pretty thorough? Well, it was rigorous. I mean, he's got a lot on the line. This is not something that you want to mess up. So he is extremely thorough. It is a rigorous examination. All right, now Paul uses that same word to describe what had happened to him. I was examined rigorously. I was examined strenuously. All this stuff was checked out to the greatest degree possible, and yet what happened? I am now here instead of being freed. All right, so that's one of the places where it's used 16 times in the New Testament. Let's take a look at Acts chapter 4 and verse 9. Now, back in Acts chapter 4, we've got some information about Peter and John. It begins back in Acts chapter 3. You may remember that there was this man. He was impotent. He was not able to walk. People carried him. And that sickness had existed from his mother's womb. So the authorities, they see the healing. They know that Peter and John are unlearned men. They were not like the Jewish elite. And this is what we have in Acts 4 and verse 9. Another use of the word. Who has it? Gary? And wants to read.
If we are being examined today concerning a good deed done to a crippled man, by what means this man has been healed?
All right, the Jewish officials, how closely do you think they wanted to scrutinize this matter? I mean, they were going to be like ants in a picnic. I mean, they were going to be all over it, right? Because if this stood, they could see their livelihood. It was just going to go down the tube. So they were going to look at this from every possible angle, and that is how the word is being used there. All right, here's another place we find it. A little later in the book of Acts. Acts chapter 12 and verse 19. Then we'll skip over to Acts chapter 17 and then end with 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 3. We're not going to run any more than that. Acts chapter 12 and verse 19. This is an account of Peter. Kind of what we're talking about earlier as far as how the book of Acts sort of splits between Paul and Peter. Up through about Acts chapter 12, you have a focus on Peter by and large. Acts chapter 12, verse 19. Who wants it? Gary, back to you.
And after Herod searched him and did not find him, he examined the centuries in order that they should be put to death. Then he went down from Judea to Caesarea to spend time there.
All right, an angelic release is involved in getting Peter out of jail. The king is not happy, so he examines, same word that Paul is using in Acts chapter 28 to describe his examination. He examines the guards. What do you think that examination was like for the guards? I would say it was very thorough. It'd be like the police. You're in the interrogation booth. They ask you the same question again, 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 again. And maybe they ask it in different ways, but they're like, you know, the dog with the bone. They're not going to let it go. And that's what Paul is trying to convey. They examined me. You know, this was an in-depth, you know, interrogation. I mean, everybody checked it out. We had two governors check me out. We had the king check me out. I was held for a long time. The Jews were allowed to come. Remember the orator that we talked about? All those things. This was looked at from every possible direction. All right, here's another place. Acts chapter 17 and verse 11, then we'll finish up with 1 Corinthians 4 and verse 3. Acts chapter 17, verse 11, mom to you.
These were more fair-minded than those in Thessalonica, in that they received the word with all readiness and searched the scriptures daily to find out whether these things were so.
Okay, they searched or they examined the scriptures daily. When you read that verse, and it's a very common verse, what's the image that you get in our head? Somebody picks up a Bible, flips over to page 22, reads, well, a couple words, that's very nice, shuts it, and comes back a week or a month later. Uh-uh. When they examined the scriptures, what did they do?
They were diligent.
I have appreciated this congregation for a number of things over the years. It is really a fine, fine group. And there have been a few times where I've been caught. Somebody said, hey, you had a wrong reference up there this morning. That doesn't bother me. Hopefully I check them, but every once in a while that does happen. I think, good for you. You know, you examine the scriptures. I've had people tell me, I see it in a slide, but I want to see it in my own Bible. I don't object to that. That's a wonderful thing. So when you think about Acts chapter 17 and verse 11, they examined the scriptures. They studied it. I'm not sure I would have wanted to be a Bible class teacher there. No, I'm just kidding on that. But they really wanted to know, does this check out? Is this really what God is saying in this particular text? And that is the same word that Paul is using to describe the examination he received. One more, 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 3. 1 Corinthians 4, verse 3. Gary?
But with me it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by any human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself.
Okay, now Paul had some issues with the Corinthians, or we might say the Corinthians had some issues with Paul. So Paul says, you have judged me. Paul says, you have examined me. What kind of microscope do you think that they used for Paul? I'd say it was one that was high-powered. I mean, they were looking at him critically. They were trying to find some things about him in his life. And you see that. They say, well, you know, he's not impressive, his physical stature. He's not impressive about his speech. You know, he writes these weighty letters. But they were very, very critical of Paul. And that's what, again, this word is telling us. People made a critical examination of Paul. Now, with all that in mind, let's go back and read verse 18 again. And when they had examined me, what did they do? They... Again, Lois?
They were willing to release him.
Okay. That's a translation which I'm going to say missed it a little bit. You have anything other than willing? Because when you say, well, I'm willing to do that, what might that say? I'm willing to do that.
Not sure.
Oh, you're okay. You're not sure? Or what else?
You could be kind of forced to.
Yeah, I really don't want to. So that may not be the best rendering here. Anybody have a different word?
Wished to set me.
All right. Wished is stronger. Anybody else?
Unsaid. Wanted to let me go.
All right. That gets even a little bit better. The ASV says they desired. They desired to set me free. When somebody says, I desire to do that, what are they saying to you? This isn't some little maybe, I wish, I hope, I could do that. I desire to do that. What is that? That almost reeks of desperation. And then when you add in the fact that Paul uses the imperfect tense, they not only desired, not the one-time deal, but they continuously desired. They repeatedly desired. This was something that, you know, they really focused on. And they desired to set me at liberty. Why? Because there was no cause of death in me. There was nothing that they could come up with. This is almost kind of like what you have with Jesus and Pilate. He really wanted to let Jesus go. But he knew if he did that, what was going to happen? It's probably going to be a riot. And if he didn't lose his life, he's probably going to lose his job. So again, Paul is telling the Jews, these chief, these leading people, hey, this is what happened to me. And again, just trying to kind of skirt around the fact that the Jews had created all these problems, sort of shifting the blame over there to Felix and Festus and the king. They really wanted to release me, but that didn't happen. And where have I ended up? I'm now here with you in Rome. Now, if you heard all that, do you think you might be scratching your head a little bit and thinking, boy, this is really kind of interesting. I'd like to know a little bit more about this guy. The facts just don't seem to be stacking up too well. Okay, anything you want to add or ask about that before we move down a little bit more? Okay. So we have Paul finally saying what in those verses? I was finally constrained to do something. It's in verse 19. But when the Jews spake against it, do you see the point? Paul says, governors and the king, they really wanted to release me, but who had really put up a fuss? There were those Jews, not saying it was you, but there were some Jews, and Paul said was out of options. Yep, nothing I could do. 2 years, confinement, Caesarea, no hope. They kept pressing the matter, pressing the matter. It would be like somebody today who says, you know, they kept poking me, they kept prodding me, and I finally just hauled off and slapped him. All right, well, you probably didn't have to do that. So it's not a perfect illustration, but that's what Paul is saying here. I had no other choice. I was constrained to appeal to Caesar. Not the ideal choice, but when you exhaust all options, sometimes that's just what you have to do. All right, now as you look at 19b, let's take a look at that. Paul says, not that I had aught whereof to accuse what?
My nation.
Again, he kind of backs off a little bit and he says, I'm not trying to get the Jewish people into trouble. I really didn't want to do this. It would be like today somebody saying, I had to report this to the police. I had to go to the authorities. I did not have any choice. I'm sorry. But all my other options were simply no longer on the table. So if you were to look at Paul based on all the things that we would say, would you say that Paul was the accuser or the accused? Or maybe we have to split the difference a little bit. Was he the accuser, the accused, or we have to split the difference a little bit? We have to split the, because he really is the accused. But at the same time, he does have to put a little bit of blame over there on the Jews, because had they not done what they did, he would not have been in this circumstance. And again, circling back to where we were earlier in the class, God sometimes, when he answers those prayers, he does some very interesting things. Reminds us oftentimes of what Isaiah said. Back in chapter 55, God's thoughts are not our thoughts. His ways are higher than our ways. All right, so the apostle tells the people, these Jewish officials, that he wanted to speak with them, verse 20, and he is able to do that. Paul says that there is a hope. Israel says that he has a hope. Well, when you see that word hope, does that bring to mind any passage in the New Testament? I have a hope. Ephesians 4. Oh, wait. Let's see. What are the four prison epistles? What's the first one?
Ephesians.
We'll come back to that, and then Philippians, and then Colossians, and then Philemon. Okay, and in that first one, Ephesians, doesn't he have some things to say about ones? There is one hope. You remember that? One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, one hope. There is one hope, and that's what he's talking about here. He says, Israel has a hope. And then he says, for that hope, he says, I'm bound for that hope. And that word which is translated bound is expressed with the present tense. Paul says, I am bound, I am continuously bound with this chain for the hope of Israel. Then, of course, the hope would have been the Messiah, and included in that would be the resurrection of all people at the end of time. So Paul, as he talks about this chain, and I think maybe he was, you know, a little more bound up at this time than later when he was just chained to that soldier. But that word here at least means to be bound around. Now, normally, if you were a Roman in this day and time, you would not have been bound with the chain. Chains, just like today, if you see somebody in handcuffs, what's the, and it's not always a correct assumption, but what is typically assumed? See somebody in handcuffs. All right, you assume that they did something wrong. If you are driving along and you see someone who's, you know, carrying the big old ball and chain, you know, they're out there with the leg irons. We don't see that too often around here, but again, what's the assumption? Well, you're definitely guilty of something, and they really don't want you to run away. You're probably a flight risk. So chains, for better or worse, oftentimes do create a very quick image in our minds. And remember, Paul still has a significant amount of freedom. We saw that back in verse 16. But the chain is a reminder, a constant reminder, that he is not free, at least in the eyes of Rome. So here is an example. You know, one of the things that I've kind of kept with me over the years has been useful to me, and I've tried to pass it on to some others, and hopefully it's been useful to them, is I was able to sit in, before I exited the military, on a program which was designed to help people who were retiring from the military. And I didn't retire from the service, but one of the things that it took away from that particular program was, as these guys were trying to leave the military and then, you know, rebrand themselves in the civilian world, was they were told, you need to take all the negatives and turn them into positives when you go out and you start looking for a job. And we know that, I think, to some degree. If you are old and you go out for a job application, and you know, you, how would you do that? You know, you're old, and perhaps you're looking for young people. How would you market yourself?
Talk about all your work experience.
There you go. That's it. I might be old, but I know some things that the young whippersnappers don't, right? So you have sometimes those kinds of things that people do. Now, here's Paul. He's got this chain. Does that look like an asset or not? I mean, it looks, it makes him, it doesn't make him look good. So if you're going to do what I just mentioned, then you have to take that negative and you have to turn it into a positive. So how's he going to do that? Yeah, it's true. You know, I'm chained. Maybe at this time he's got a chain that's actually binding him. Switches to the hand chain a little bit later. But I've got this chain. That's bad, but what? Guess what? Hey, guys. It's for your benefit. I'm chained because of the hope that Israel has. So you see, I think, I don't know if you want to call it psychology, but anyway, I believe that he was speaking by inspiration, and it was a brilliant move on his part.